Welcome to St. Louis on the Air. I'm Don Marsh. You can come early and stay late at the next big birthday party to be held in St. Louis. That would be the 250th anniversary or semi-quincentennial of the city's founding. The official founding date is next February, but it will be commemorated starting next New Year's Eve and continue throughout the entire year. The organization STL 250 is heavily involved in that planning, which will include a wide variety of events, scores of them in the city and the county. Today we're talking about a very ambitious exhibit taken on by the Missouri History Museum. It's called 250 in 250, referencing the anniversary and the number of components in the exhibit. In studio from the museum to talk about it are Jody Sowell, Director of Exhibitions and Research. Gwen Moore is Curator of Urban Landscape and Community, and Andrew Wunko is a researcher. Thank you all so much for being with us. Nice to have you here.
Thank you.
Thank you, Don.
Jody, I'll begin with you. Give me some sense of how you pulled this together. I mean, it's a massive exhibit, even for you guys.
It is a massive exhibit, and we're right in crunch time. So we're editing and writing labels as we speak. Yes, we decided, 250 years is a big deal. Clearly, the History Museum wants to be front and center in this anniversary year and come up with an exhibit that will engage St. Louisans with their history. I suppose the easiest thing for us to do would have been to do an exhibit about the city's founding, and that would have been a fine exhibit. But we really wanted to come up with something that would cover that whole span of time and really show the richness, diversity, and complexity of that history, give you some selections you might not expect. So that's how we chose this 50-50-50-50-50 framework.
I didn't expect to see that emos would make the cut, but in fact it did.
Oh, there's some prizes in there. So we're saying these are not the 50 most important people, places, images, objects. These are 50 that really represent that diversity and that richness in those fascinating stories in each section.
How have you broken it down, the 50-50-50?
Sure. So it's 50 people, 50 places, 50 images, 50 moments, and 50 objects. And I always catch myself to see if I've left out one, but that all adds up to 250. And each section's a little different. The 50 moments section, for example, that's all firsthand accounts of St. Louis history. So these are eyewitness accounts, some of them historical, some of them from today. The 50 images section is actually going to be an image theater. You'll go in and see these 50 images sort of spanning across the screen with a soundtrack, and those are 50 images of everyday St. Louisans throughout the years. So,
well, let's get some perspective from some of the people who are certainly a big part of all of this. We'll start with you, Gwen. Tell us about your role and the areas in which you were most actively involved.
Well, I'm a curator, and that means my focus is objects. But I had been doing a lot of research on what I considered a very important institution in the African-American community, the People's Finance Building. And I want to make sure that that particular institution got into the exhibit because a lot of people don't know about it. It was the brainchild of seven black men. One of them was J.E. Mitchell, the publisher of the St. Louis Argus. One was George Buckner, the first director of the Urban League. And there was two doctors, a dentist, a pharmacist. But they got together in 1923 and decided that they were going to start a general loan business called the People's Finance Corporation for African Americans. And it was one of the first in the country, started by blacks for blacks. And it was located in Mill Creek. Well, 2 years later, they decided they were going to be more ambitious, and they were going to build a building, which was going to be the first commercial building, so the Argus says, the first commercial building built by African Americans in the country.
I was just going to say, I'm sure it's a facility that was necessary for the African-American
Absolutely.
Community because there were no other options.
There were no others. Yeah. And it was finished in 1926. And what I consider really interesting about this is that they went out and they solicited community support. They went to churches and they encouraged the black community to commit money to this. And they wound up getting 1,200 people to invest and raised $500,000. And they built that building. It was a stately five-story building with marble stairs and brass accents. It was a beautiful building, and it became the center of African-American life in St. Louis. It was located in the Mill Creek area, Jefferson, 11th North Jefferson, or Jefferson and Market. And every important African-American institution was located there. I mean, there was the NAACP, the March on Washington movement, the Brotherhood of Sleeping Car Porters, the St. Louis American was there. A lot of well-known doctors, lawyers, dentists had their offices there. And that's where the movers and shakers of St. Louis were kind of black, would congregate to discuss, you know, their next move, their next strategy. Whenever Thurgood Marshall came to town, of course, he'd go to People's Finance Building because that's where the NAACP was there. So A. Philip Randolph was there. So it was a very, very important building. It was buzzing with so much activity that it just became known as the Hub. That was his nickname.
And the status of that building is what?
Well, it was in Mill Creek. And as we know, Mill Creek was leveled. And I think only one building was left standing out of 5,400. And unfortunately, this really important, what I consider a really important landmark and a really, really important institution was knocked down by the wrecking ball. The other thing I wanted to say is that African Americans considered this more than just bricks and mortar. It was more than a building. To them, it was a race enterprise. It represented the fulfillment of black aspirations and a monument to black achievement. One of the things that the Argus kept saying over and over again is, you know, this shows what we can do if we pool our resources and pull together. So it was more important than just a building. It represented something so much bigger.
It is a shame that a building like that is lost, but so many buildings have been lost, not only in Mill Creek, but down in the area of the Arch. I mean, we lost a lot of history down there with some of those fine buildings.
Absolutely.
Well, and our place section really does capture that. It captures both places that have been erased from the physical landscape and oftentimes aren't remembered anymore, and gives you places that you pass every day and tells you stories that you might not expect.
It's going to be a fascinating exhibit. Andrew, let me turn to you. As a researcher, what sort of challenges did you face?
Well, my background is in architectural history and urban planning. Before starting with the Missouri History Museum, I worked with the Landmarks Association of St. Louis, and one of the most exciting things that they've been involved in the last couple of years was the saving of the South Grand Flying Saucer. And that happens to be one of our 50 places that we chose to represent the breadth of St. Louis history through place. It really holds the flying saucer was one that I really lobbied for hard right from the beginning, because I was actually in the Board of Aldermen meetings, like listening in on the future of this building. Would it stand or would it fall like so many have in the past? The flying saucer was built in 1967 as a Phillips 66 gas station for the Council Plaza housing development. It was a all-inclusive housing development for senior citizens, where they had markets and businesses, and basically senior citizens would never have to leave their home.
It was a Teamsters operation,
right.
Wasn't it?
Yeah. Right, built by the Teamsters. Yeah. And so somewhere along the line, I don't know when, it became a Del Taco fast food franchise, and that's what that's its colloquial nickname was, of course, the Del Taco building. When it was announced that it could be torn down, the Land Reutilization Authority put out a blighting study in June 2011 that went to the Board of Aldermen. And what was so amazing was to see that immediately there was such a strong response for this, what you would really call an ugly duckling building. It's not beautiful in the traditional sense of the word. It's beautiful because of what it represents to a vibrant city as a unique structure that can't be replicated anywhere else. I've heard it called Sputnik modernism because of its 120-foot cantilevered concrete roof. It's amazing to see that there was such a quick response. And then in August 2011, of course, developer Rick Yackey and Alderwoman Marlene Davis announced that they would try to save the building. And it was really the public outcry that caused them to have this change of heart. So in September 2012... St. Louis could proudly say we have the first Starbucks in a spaceship, which is a pretty cool thing to see that a really youthful undercurrent came together for a building that is seemingly had no historic significance from a traditional standpoint. But to them, it was important in creating a vibrant city.
All of this 48 years after, yeah. after the founding city. I try to think of what the founding fathers might have thought if they pulled up about a flying saucer type building. Well, you know, did you want to say something?
And Don, you're getting a glimpse into some of the discussions we've had at the History Museum. Clearly, we have... all these people with all this knowledge and all these different corners of St. Louis history, and we sort of got together around conference tables and argued it out and said, who should be in the 50 people? Who should be in the 50 places? I tell a lot of people I had someone on our facilities crew who I think followed me on most days and told me 20 or 30 times how much trouble I would be in if Chuck Berry didn't make it on the list of 50 people. So you had so much passion from these people who work at the Missouri History Museum about the history of their community and sharing those stories, maybe some stories you wouldn't expect.
Yeah, you know, I would think, Gwen, that there would be a temptation, however, because we are here now, and this is a 250-year period we're talking about, there would be a temptation to really focus more on current history, a reasonably current history, as opposed to going all the way back, because of the difficulty in doing that in many cases.
Well, especially with African-American history, sometimes sources become a problem, and going back and finding people that we know existed and contributed so much, but you have to be able to tell their story, and that becomes a problem. One of the people that we didn't, well, I'll talk about an object. One of the objects that we have is a Poro pressing oil tin. And Poro was the company that was founded by Annie Malone. And of course, there's a lot of information about Annie Malone. But I think that a lot of people who might know Annie Malone and know that she built this empire based on beauty products might not know other aspects of the work that she did. And I think that's one of the things that we wanted to do, even with people that we were familiar with or that we think St. Louisans might be familiar with. We wanted to tell a different story. And one of the things that I wanted to focus on with this pressing oil tin is that this pressing oil tin not only represented an amazing amount of wealth, because she was rumored to be a millionaire. I'm not sure, but she was extremely wealthy. But it's what she did with her money that fascinated me. Not how much, how she made it was pretty amazing as well, because this is a woman who had to overcome barriers of race, class, gender. And in a time when women, period, did not have a lot of opportunities.
You know, I'm just thinking that if we were talking about the 150th anniversary, you know, there probably wouldn't be a lot of reference to African Americans.
I would hope there would be.
There would be if we were doing it.
Going back 100 years, though, and think of what the climate was then.
That's true.
I think that there probably would have been much less.
Well, I think, sadly, you're right. Yeah. I think there's still a challenge. For example, African-American objects. We don't have as many of those as we would like to have. And I think one of the things that I want to do is make that outreach to the African-American community and tell them to donate their items so we can tell their stories. Because one of the things I've learned about doing exhibits, if you don't have the objects, it's difficult to tell the story because you just can't put it in writing and put it on the wall. You have to have an object.
People don't want to necessarily come in and just read something. They want to see something a little more tangible.
Exactly.
I have to take a break now. We'll do that. My guests in studio are Jody Sowell, Director of Exhibitions and Research at the Missouri History Museum; Gwen Moore, from whom we just heard, is Curator of Urban Landscape and Community Objects and Community at the museum; Andrew Wonko is a researcher who is heavily involved in researching for the exhibit, which is going to be opening when, Jody? When does this all start?
It's February 14th.
Well, what a coincidence. That happens to be the actual anniversary. Yeah. We'll come back and talk more about the history of our community, and perhaps you'd like to get into the conversation and tell us about some of the things you would like to see highlighted or would like to know more about. Give us a call at 382-8255. That's 382-TALK. We'll take an email at talk@stlpublicradio.org. You can also send us a tweet at STL on Air. Back in just a moment. We hope to hear from you. This is St. Louis on the Air on St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU. Hello again, and welcome back as we continue our discussion on what the Missouri History Museum is planning and preparing for the 250th anniversary of the founding of the city of St. Louis. We'll get to more of that conversation in a moment. But here are some of the stories our St. Louis Public Radio newsroom is following today. This morning, Governor Nixon explained his veto of HB 301, saying it would undermine victims' rights and weaken public safety by relaxing state laws regarding sexual offenders. Officials at Lambert Airport are expected to announce a major new economic development initiative, and Metro East officials are commenting on higher speed limits limits on Illinois highways. These stories and more this afternoon on St. Louis Public Radio and throughout the day on stlouispublicradio.org. Now back to our discussion. Andrew, I'll turn to you. Getting back to the research, you talked about some of the things that you've done with regard to the more modern era. What are some of the difficulties you faced in going back beyond that, well beyond that?
Like Gwen mentioned earlier, the farther you go back, the less sources you often have, especially for these groups that at the time were seen as marginalized or unimportant. You mentioned if this was the 150th anniversary, African Americans would probably see very little representation. Another group that probably would see little representation is obviously the Asian community, because at that time they were seen as quite unassimilable and just curious outsiders. And so one of the interesting places we're looking at is Hop Alley, which was St. Louis' original Chinatown. Now it is underneath Philip Johnson's General American Life Insurance Building, which was put up in 1977. Starting in the 1860s, the Chinese community in St. Louis occupied a thin alley that existed between 7th and 8th Street and Market and Walnut. And they were really a tight-knit community in this small corridor of tenements and hand laundries and Chinese restaurants. And to the outside world, they were seen as a zoo, nearly, of curiosity. There's old newspaper articles where white men go into Chinatown, into Hop Alley, and try a Chinese restaurant, and they write about all the peculiar things they see. And, of course, they're highly racially biased. But it's interesting to look at it from the other perspective, that to the Chinese, this was really a cultural anchor. This was what gave them a community in a land where they didn't speak the language and they were distrusted and they didn't have job opportunities. The police would often raid Hop Alley for no apparent reason, just sort of out of paranoia. But by the time Hop Alley was still going strong, even into the 1960s, and when the Bush Stadium Urban Renewal Project came along and basically wiped out the entire southern half of downtown, Hop Alley was seen as just another blighted area needing clearance.
About the name, you talk about the racial bias that existed. It seems to me that could be evident in the name.
The name is a point of debate. It's either a skewing of traditional Cantonese names, like Hop Sing would be the name of a Cantonese person, or it's obviously a reference to opium, which is what the Chinese were sort of stereotyped as being. Opium lords and a very dangerous place for outsiders to be.
Interesting. And now, obviously, long gone.
Long gone.
Long gone. Much, yeah. A much greater degree of assimilation. Jody, so the question that I have is, we all say in the movies and the television that a lot of stuff is left on the editing room floor and nobody knows what's there. So what? What was left on the editing room floor as you were making your decisions that maybe you wish now had been in or should have been in? Or
So many things. So we would get on around a conference room table and have index cards and put out the index cards of all the people we thought for the people section should be included. And then we would pin up the ones on the wall that were actually going to make it. And we had incredible debates. I know one person that I oftentimes lobbied for was William Carr Lane, who was the first mayor of St. Louis. Seems like someone who should be included. I lost that battle, Don. but, I mean, an interesting person, a guy who lobbied hard for our streets to be named after trees like they did in Philadelphia. So when you drive down Olive or Chestnut, you're literally driving on part of his legacy. So he has a fascinating story to tell, but won't quite make it into this one. So again, that's why it's so important for us to say we're not picking the 50 most important people. Maybe if we were, maybe the first mayor of St. Louis makes that list. But to tell these fascinating snapshots of St. Louis history, we had to make some pretty tough decisions.
I'm sure it was very difficult. We have a number of people who want to get into the conversation. Let's bring them in. We'll start with Andrew, who's calling from St. Louis. Andrew, thanks for being with us. Go ahead.
Hi, Don. Good afternoon, everybody. I was just wondering kind of the issues you encounter in researching some of these topics. I mean, it seems to me that there's got to be a strong divide between kind of appealing to the public, but also still kind of conducting that deep historical research. I was wondering if you could just comment a little bit on that.
All right. Thanks for the call. Joe, do you want to start that?
Sure. That also goes to sort of what sort of stories we can tell. I oftentimes talk about that we are really commemorating St. Louis's 250th anniversary and not celebrating St. Louis's 250th anniversary. Now that might only make a difference to me, but it makes a pretty big difference to me because we want to tell both the darker stories of St. Louis history, the stories that we may not be incredibly proud of, but also the celebratory stories. So it's not just a matter of research, it's also a matter of what kind of stories are we going to tell. So we want to tell those stories that that maybe didn't make St. Louisans particularly proud at the time, or that are possibly complex. How do we tell a story of Pruitt-Igoe? For some people, that's a story that is only a negative, and for other people, they remind us that there were lots of positives in that development. So telling those stories in a complex way is something we always strive to do, while still telling it in a way that that engages with the public so that they will read those labels and look at those objects and keep coming back for more.
Any thoughts from Gwen or from Andrew on
well, I think what you mentioned before, sometimes it's very difficult to research groups that have been on the margins, African-Americans, immigrants, people that weren't necessarily what we used to call articulate. They didn't leave behind written records, or we didn't bother to collect their records or collect their objects, which makes it more difficult to tell their stories. So research really becomes a challenge, but that's a challenge that I like. So I do spend a lot of time really trying to dig as deep as I can and find as any sliver of information that I can.
You know, Andrew, the story of the immigrants in St. Louis is really an important one, too. As I understand it, in the mid-1800s, there were more immigrants in St. Louis than New York City.
I'm not sure if there were more by number, but there certainly were just as diverse a number of groups from countries of origin. St. Louis was a massive immigration center. And I think the interesting thing about getting back to the what the caller was saying about public interest versus deep research, I think rather than focusing on deep research, what's really interesting about this exhibit is that we can convince people that they are surrounded by history everywhere they look. Like, literally, in St. Louis, every street corner has something historic about it, whether it be big history, like the founding or the arch or something, versus even just an immigrant's corner storefront. It's bathed in history, and opening people's eyes to that is very exciting.
And it's evidenced today by certain neighborhoods, too. I mean, I think of the Hill, for instance, which really is just indicative of that the Italian population that was so omnipresent here not too many years ago, which brings to mind the Irish, which takes me to Mark, who's calling from Clayton. I think he wants to bring the Irish into it, and being part Irish myself, I welcome his call.
I was just thinking about this as I was listening to the program, is that I know up until 1849, about 43% of St. Louis was the Irish up in Cary Patch. Well, Cary Patch was, part of that was built into Pruitt-Igoe, and that, but there are still remnants of that area and those buildings that are still standing. And I'm just curious if any part of this is going to cover that aspect of St. Louis.
Here's one thing I tell people, Don. So we get these anytime I go out and start talking about the exhibit, people will ask, well, are you going to include this or are you going to include that? What I oftentimes tell people is that if you're interested in a certain aspect of St. Louis history, it's probably going to show up somewhere. So if you are interested in the founding of St. Louis or the architecture of St. Louis or immigration in St. Louis, you're probably going to find it somewhere. It might not be exactly how you wanted it, might not include the exact place that you were looking for or the exact person you were looking for, but we have, I think at least, and Gwen and Andrew can correct me if I'm wrong, I think we've done a great job of covering all sorts of different areas. That includes Irish immigration. It includes immigration as a whole. I can think of areas that are included in the objects section and in the people section and the places section, in the moment section. So all of these areas, I think, are covered in lots of different ways. We'll keep some of the selections close to the vest, but I think you'll find those stories that you're looking for throughout the exhibit.
Andrew, you look like you were getting ready to say something.
I was going to mention that what's really exciting about this exhibit is, like Jody was just speaking to, even if you can't find exactly what you're looking for, you can start to trace steps and make links between what we have and what you are looking for. One of the people we're featuring in this exhibit is Bishop Joseph Rosati. He was the first bishop of the Diocese of St. Louis. And obviously, St. Louis is a city with Catholic traditions that have endured. He was responsible for opening the Mullenfee Hospital. It was the first hospital west of the Mississippi River in the United States. And the hospital was, the money for the hospital came from Brian and James Mullenfee, the St. Louis first millionaire and one of the former mayors of St. Louis. The Mullenfees eventually resettled on the north side of St. Louis and opened the Mullenfee Immigrant Home in Cary Patch, which still stands today. So you could start to make those connections between what we have and what you're looking for.
Sure. Gwen, what about the Ville? I mean, we're talking about places, and I wonder historic places.
Well, I think you will not be disappointed. I think we try to be inclusive. Some of the people that I wanted didn't get in. Some of them did. Some of the places I wanted didn't get in because it couldn't just be about what Gwen wanted. It had to be...
be a good exhibit.
That would be a great exhibit, but that didn't happen. So I think you will find, like, Mill Creek... I shouldn't be revealing these things. But I don't... Like Jody said and Andrew, I think that you will find something there.
Well, I know that you're going to be dealing with the Shelley family, Shelley versus mm-hmm. Kramer, the famous Supreme mm-hmm. Court decision mm-hmm. on restrictive covenants, and that would tie in with the Ville. Andrew's talking about connecting the dots, and this is one of the ways that could be done because that was the basic place where African Americans had lived in St. Louis for a long, long time.
The Ville, Mill Creek. Right, and, of course, right. We had, like, enclaves, like in Carondelet and certain enclaves. But those were the two major African-American neighborhoods.
But they could own property in the Ville, couldn't they not? Those who lived there?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Whereas it was not so easy in other places, as Shelley versus Kramer would
restrictive covenants.
Because of the restrictive mm-hmm. covenant. We have some tweets that have come in as people learned what was going to be discussed on the program today. I'll read a couple. Leslie said, asked about what person, place, or moment would you feature in an exhibit like this. Well, Leslie, no offense, but this is a no-brainer. Dred Scott is the first name on the list. I know, without even asking, that's going to be dealt with in your exhibit. How about David Francis, the mayor, governor, promoter of the 1904 World's Fair?
That's a good idea. I think he'll be happy on that count too.
You don't want to give away the whole thing.
I don't. I think part of it is coming to find out who we did include, and an important part is that visitors will get to join in on the conversation. So if they want to look at our 50 people and then say, "I can't believe you left this person out," there will be an opportunity to do that.
Well, we have another one. Craig says he thinks should be a part of it. The day that Adolphus Bush met Lily Anheuser and soon her dad Everhart, and the rest, as they say,
is history.
Is history? Yeah, that there are some others here, but I don't think I'm going to get very far with these. I'll try a little bit later. Let's go back to the phones and bring in Eric, who's calling from St. Louis. Go ahead, Eric.
I would hope that you tell the story of the rebirth of downtown with 100 buildings, all of which are historic buildings, and the rebirth of neighborhoods, which has now laid the foundation for an explosion of entrepreneurial activity in St. Louis. And if you haven't made that part of the story, it's another opportunity to tell the story so people really know what's going on, and also how it really came about through a broad-based coalition of people coming together, working on the historic tax credit.
I think that's a great idea. It really goes to sort of one of the hearts of this exhibit, which is the fact that we did want to be able to tell that full span of time. There are fascinating things going on in St. Louis today that historians will be talking about in the future, and that rebirth of downtown, around the Garment District as well, this rebirth of neighborhoods, this rebirth of, I think, interest in city living is an important part of the St. Louis story. We might just be seeing the first parts of it, but clearly an important part of that story that we wouldn't be able to do if we just talked about the founding, if we didn't approach it this way.
We did a program a few weeks ago with the author of a book called The Gateway Arch, and anyone who is interested in the history and how that area was raised, if you will, in order to accommodate the Jefferson Memorial, that's the book to take a look at. Right. It's really quite a story and quite a tragic loss of some wonderful architecture. I know, Andrew, you're probably well aware of all of that. Let's go back to the phones. And John in Godfrey, Illinois, I'm glad we're getting some representation from the east side. John, go ahead.
Hi, Don. Thank you. I had two quick questions. First of all, I had always heard that the Chase Park Plaza Hotel did not allow black ball players, some of the early pioneers like Jackie Robinson and the fellas that followed. They Chase Park Plaza would not let those ball players stay there when the teams would come to town. And I wondered if there is an actual hotel that a picture exists of or some sort of record of where the black ball players had to go when they came to St. Louis. And secondly, Don, my aunt, she's passed away, but she told me that back in the 20s and 30s, she remembers that on certain days in St. Louis, there was actually soot that would kind of fall from the sky because St. Louis had such an industrial base and coal was used quite often. And A, I wondered if that was true, and B, if there's any pictures of St. Louis at that time when apparently smog was a big problem.
Thanks very much for the call. I'm going to ask our guests in studio to just hold on for a moment while I take another break because I don't want to interrupt the responses with this break that we have to take. So we'll come back and talk more about St. Louis history as we prepare to observe the 250th anniversary of the founding of St. Louis. Back in just a moment. This is St. Louis on the Air on St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU. Hello again and welcome back as we continue our conversation on St. Louis history. With me in studio is Jody Sowell, Director of Exhibitions and Research at the Missouri History Museum. Gwen Moore is Curator of Urban Landscape and Community Identity at the museum. Andrew Wonka was a researcher, all involved in a big exhibit that's going to be opening next February and commemorating the 250th anniversary. Okay, we had two questions from our last caller. Let's take the soot question first because I think that's an easier one to answer than the other issue we raised.
It is an easy one, but it also speaks to how great that moment section is going to be in our exhibit. So, yes, that's absolutely true that St. Louis was blanketed by coal smoke in the 20s and 30s. But as I mentioned, that moment section is all firsthand accounts of St. Louis history. And in that, we have a great firsthand account of someone talking about walking down the streets, having to wear masks over their face, not being able to see their hands in front of the face, and that eerie glow that you could see from the street lamps trying to get through that thick blanket of smoke.
How are the moment, is the moment, the 50 moments going to be presented? Is it simply
that'll be an audio section.
Audio,
so you can come and pick, and for some of those, you will hear actual excerpts from oral history interviews. Others, you'll hear an actor reading a historical account.
All right. Now we'll move on to the other part of it. Gwen, I'm going to turn to you for that because this is certainly an example of a period of time in which St. Louis should not be terrifically proud. It wasn't only the Chase where ball players and entertainers.
No, St. Louis was segregated. Jim Crow in St. Louis, just like it was in Alabama, Mississippi, Georgia, any other southern state, any other southern city. And not by law. That was the only difference, but by custom and tradition. So, no, the Chase did not allow blacks. There's an incident where Josephine Baker, for example, couldn't stay at the Chase. Dorothy Dandridge was coming to St. Louis, she couldn't stay in the Chase.
Sarah Vaughan.
Yeah. So it happened quite a bit. Lena Horne. So African Americans basically had to stay at African American hotels, and there were a few. And one of going back to Annie Malone, one of the things that she wanted was hotel accommodations. Mm-hmm. So when African Americans came to St. Louis, they would have a good place to stay, a nice place to stay. Because usually you had to stay in somebody's house. That's usually the way it happened because you couldn't stay in the hotels. So she would, Paul Robeson stayed at her hotel, which was located in the Poirot building, Louise Beavers, Marian Anderson, when she came to perform here in St. Louis, stayed there. So it's just a matter of our history. Now, we did pass a public accommodations law in 1961, which made a municipal public accommodations law, which made segregating of public facilities illegal.
Yeah. Now, your caller also mentioned sports history, of course, and that's also a big part of the exhibit. So he mentioned the Negro League. The Negro League is mentioned in a couple of places. We talk a lot about Stars Park. I think we have an object that Gwen was writing about. We also have plenty of representations from the Cardinals. And we had an interesting, I don't know if you call it a competition, earlier this year where we had an Artifact Madness competition during the NCAA tournament. And visitors to our website could choose which artifact they wanted to make it in that 50 objects list. Maybe not surprisingly, a sports object one that was a St. Louis Browns uniform. So that will be included as well. So those interested in St. Louis sports history will also find a lot in this exhibit.
It's not the uniform of Eddie Goodell, is it?
It's not. I can't remember whose uniform it was, although Sharon, one of our curators, will rap me on the knuckles for not remembering. But it is a great example of an object that tells a larger story, this great story of when St. Louis was home to two baseball teams. Lots of people have fond memories of the 1944 World Series, which, of course, was an all St. Louis World Series.
The reference to Eddie Goodell, by the way, for people who don't know, was the undersized ball player that Bill Veeck brought in to
the Browns were known for their stunts.
And Bill Veeck in particular was known for perpetrating them. Andrew, we had a guest on the show a year or two ago, and we started to talk and realized this big anniversary was coming up. The professor, and forgive me, Faust, I think his name was, at University of Missouri, St. Louis. One of the things he said is that no one is really quite sure whether February 14th or February 15th is the actual date of the founding, if you will. What have you found out?
Well, I found out a lot of people have very strong opinions on that question. February 14th was the date that August Schoto landed at St. Louis, at the site that would become St. Louis. And February 15th is the date that he started building the buildings that would make up the fur trading settlement of St. Louis. So which one of those it is, I guess, is lost to history, and it doesn't help that one of the primary sources we have is his journal to justify this. But we realized quickly that a lot of people do get caught up in those very specific aspects of history. And I think right away we wanted to make sure this exhibit didn't get caught up in that kind of nitpicky type looking at history. We wanted a very broad scope.
So it's February 14th.
Yeah.
and that's that. And
right.
I know there's a big deal going on in Forest Park, the SDL 250 folks. Are you working with them? I assume you're pretty closely
associated. We're working really closely with the SDL at 250 group. They're doing great events across the city throughout the year, amazing, amazing things, from lecture series to big parties to first nights. So they are doing great work. We wanted to be sort of the cornerstone of the history of this community. So that's our role. But yes, we've been working very closely with them.
Getting back to the Schoto for just a moment, we have a Facebook post here. Someone would like, and I don't have a name, unfortunately, who says that Madame Schoto should be a part of whatever you guys are doing. Unlike Pierre Laclede, her long-term lover, partner, and father of four of her children, she was a financial success, a savvy businesswoman, a progressive in her milieu, and a risk-taker, and a great influence on the development of St. Louis. So I'm guessing that she has to be a part of
it. We're convinced, Don.
You're not helping me very much, Jody.
No, she's included. I'm trying to tell you she's included.
Well, I think that she would have to be. Melody, via Twitter, says Gaslight Square is something that people certainly remember, of a certain age certainly remember, but that it was a big part of our city's history.
That's great, and I think that's an example of there are places and people who you might see in multiple categories. I believe, if my memory is correct, that Gaslight Square will be in the place section, but we also have, I think, recorded just yesterday a great memory from someone talking about sort of the heyday of Gaslight Square and her memories of that.
Boy, and it would be nice to have some recordings from Gaslight Square during the heyday. Mm-hmm. People like Barbara Streisand showing up and all the Smothers Brothers and mm-hmm. people like that. Anyway, a couple of names I see on the list here, people that that I happen to know, having been around here for a long time, are Norman Say, who has been
Say.
Very, very
Absolutely.
Active, obviously, in the whole issue of civil rights. And another one that a very dear friend of mine at one point was Ken Billups.
Oh.
Who Ken, when I was yeah. at Channel 2, Ken was a fixture there for a long time and got to know him fairly well. Tell us a little bit about him, Gwen.
Ken Billups?
Yeah.
Well, the interesting thing about Ken Billups, he was a music director at Sumner yeah. High School from 1949 until he passed in 1985. In fact, he was the first native-born St. Louisan to head the music department at Sumner, because when they started Sumner High School, they had to import teachers from outside the state because we did not have a university for African Americans, so we weren't able to train African Americans. So that's a commentary on the state of affairs in St. Louis and Missouri at that time, that it was not until 1949 that we could get a native-born teacher to head a department at a black high school in the city. But Kenneth Billups was an amazing music teacher. He was amazing music historian. He started the Legend Singers. He wanted to preserve the history of African-American music, make sure that that was not lost to not just St. Louis, but to the nation. He's probably best known as being the teacher of Grace Bunbury, the mm-hmm. famous opera singer. And I think it's really interesting that he died doing what he loved. He was actually rehearsing the Legend Singers when he succumbed. So he was an amazing, amazing person.
If memory serves, a street's named after Ken Billups.
Absolutely. The Ville.
In the Ville. Okay. Mm-hmm.
It was interesting. That was one of those conversations. I think originally we had talked about Grace Bunbury. Maybe she's one of our 50 people. Mm-hmm. And then after more discussion, we thought, well, no, Kenneth Billups is really nice because he connects a lot of those people, a lot of those singers, a lot of that neighborhood.
That's Andrew, that's really a clever way to go about it. I mean, obviously, there's more than you can put in the bag. So
right.
connecting these dots mm-hmm. is terrific.
Right.
Yeah. We have a call from Bill who couldn't stay on the line. He said, is there coverage of the French-Indian connections in early St. Louis? Again, I know what you're going to do. but by the same token, that era is a – Andrew, probably you're the one to take this. That era is an important one in the founding and pre-founding.
Absolutely. And we mentioned Madame Choteau earlier, and the Choteau family was a fur-trading dynasty. So, of course, there will be discussions about their relationship with Indian groups, both good and bad. I think there'll be a lot of coverage of early St. Louis, but we definitely didn't want to focus just on that idea that St. Louis was founded 250 years ago and that's all we should look at. So it has its place, but Gaslight Square has its place, and Hop Alley sure. and the People's Finance Building, they all have their place.
But Don, your mention of pre-founding is incredibly important, and that's something we did in that in the objects section, is we really wanted objects that also told people, we can talk about 250 all we want, but of course history was here long before 250 years ago. Mm-hmm. So in there, in the objects section, here, I'll give you one or two. You will find a Mississippian culture effigy that was found near Cahokia. You will find Osage Nation staff. So you will get that understanding that history didn't just start 250 years ago, either on February 14th or February 15th.
Sure, we can mm-hmm. go back even farther than that with the Cahokian people who were here, and their society was a massive one, and their influence spread from Mexico to Wisconsin, from what I understand. So there was a lot going on here. What about the East Side? I mean, we're talking a lot about what's going on right in our immediate environment here. How, if you can tell me, is that going to be represented?
So I think, and Andrew and Gwen can jump in and tell me things I'm forgetting, but while the focus is on St. Louis City, a variety of locations outside of the city limits are also mentioned. So you will find mentions of University City. You will find mentions of Kirkwood. You will find mentions of East St. Louis. I know East St. Louis as a whole is one of our places. So there will be discussions of those areas outside of the city limits as well. And certainly the east side is included. On the opening image, you see Catherine Dunham, who, of course, is an important figure from East St. Louis. So it's represented in a variety of places.
We have a caller, and I can get Gwen and Andrew in on this, but relevant to what we're just talking about here, let's bring in Chris, who I think wants to mention another name from the area that we're talking about. Chris, are you there?
Yes, the fellow you mentioned just a minute ago, the teacher Sumner, called to mind another person that might have been considered, Richard Hudlin, who also taught, came from the University of Chicago. And, of course, his actions, it could be argued, had a very large part in desegregating the parks of St. Louis and the recreation facilities. I don't go into the whole story, but I'm sure your panel is familiar with it. And I'm just wondering if he at least got any consideration.
Good luck in getting that information. that's all I can say.
So he was talking about the Hudlins of East St. Louis?
That's what I thought he was talking about. He was talking about the Hudlin, though, in St. Louis
There were some. There were Hudlins. In fact, when I was doing research on people's finance, I kept coming across, and I thought this was very interesting, Hudlins were involved in making films in this very early period in the 20s, and they constantly had advertisements for their films. There was constantly, and it, because their grandsons are now very big in the film business, I thought that was really an interesting connection. So, yeah, they played a big role in St. Louis history.
We have a tweet from Kevin here. He says, I hope they highlight Union Station's heyday to open the conversation on what it could be again. Jody's giving me that look. Like saying, Don, would you stop?
This is what happens in every presentation we give. Did you include this? Did you include that? Which is actually great because it does spark that conversation. This is what the exhibit's about. It's not about telling you absolutely everything about St. Louis history. It's not about giving you the complete picture because no exhibit, no book can do that. It's about giving you 250 fascinating snapshots. And yes, Union Station is one of those.
This is, you know, what we call a tease. We're just whetting people's appetite for what lies ahead. What was the biggest single challenge, Jody, that you faced in all of this?
Well, the biggest challenge had to be limiting it to 50 for each section. We probably had 250, 300 possible selections for each of these categories, and each one had great reasons to do them. If we came up with this list, if we started over, and I don't want to do this, but if we started over and came up with a new list of 250, we would come up with a very different list. So it really is about what stories you tell, and then sort of how do we tell those in a way that will engage with St. Louisans and, like Andrew said earlier, sort of spark that curiosity about St. Louis history.
Yeah. Andrew, I'll ask you the same thing. From your perspective and doing research, what was the biggest challenge you faced?
I would definitely agree with Jody. This would have been a way easier exhibit if this was the 500th anniversary and we could have chose twice as many. I could have come up with 500 on my own, and so could the other 10 or 12 people we had working on this. And so what became really hard was making sure all the voices were represented. And just because somebody has a fascinating story isn't necessarily enough to get them through the door here. Sure. We really had to be very specific about who we chose. Jody mentioned earlier we had everybody up on the wall, like mugshots of these people, and we would put them to trial, and some would get ripped down, and some would go back up after being ripped down. It was pretty difficult.
And Gwen, same question to you.
Well, I say I learned a lot about collaboration and cooperation because I was very, very passionate about the people that and the places, the things that I wanted. That I thought should be there. And you can always get what you want or what you think is important. I mean, you're dealing with the ideas and the expertise and the knowledge of a lot of different people. And so I learned that sometimes you have to let go.
I'll bet all of you, and we only have a few seconds left, learned a lot in going through all of this, not only about getting along with each other, but also about our community. If I ever knew it, didn't realize that Listerine was located here. I know that I'm giving away a...
there you go again, Don.
That might be a part of it, but...
No, so we've learned so much, and we've learned so much about different people's areas. So some people are so passionate about architecture. Some people are so passionate about immigration. Some people are so passionate about early history. So mm-hmm. we learned all of these different aspects from each other. It was really one of the most collaborative efforts we've ever done at the History Museum.
Well, we'll look forward to seeing it, whatever you're going to have, starting the 14th of February next year.
That's right.
Thank you so much for being with us. Jody Sowell, the Director of Exhibitions and Research at the Missouri History Museum.
Thank you.
Gwen Moore, thank you so much for being with us. Great to see
My
you.
Pleasure.
Gwen is the Curator of Urban Landscape and Community Identity. And Andrew Wonko, thank you
thank
for
you,
all
Don.
The research and work that you've done and I'm sure are still doing, because this is a work in
yes.
progress still, isn't it? Thank you all so much. Tomorrow on St. Louis on the Air, we'll take a look at the paradox of Thomas Jefferson's views on slavery versus his status as a slave owner. We'll also talk with Senator Claire McCaskill. If you have questions for the senator, email them to talk@stlpublicradio.org, talk@stlpublicradio.org, or send us this tweet at STL on Air. Archived versions of the program is available for download or podcast at stlpublicradio.org. Thank you all so much for being with us. I'm Don Marsh. Thanks.